From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. At a time when just about every action taken by every element of the Trump administration is subjected to the deepest scrutiny by the media, a radical change in the political landscape inside the United States has been taking place with very little notice being taken by that selfsame media. We discuss some of those changes with our longtime political contributor, Professor Tony Montero.
The predictions by many, and including those on the so-called left, that the disaster would manifest itself in the rise of fascist movements, and that there would be intervention in Syria and other places. None of that has come to pass.
War with China. Remember, some people were saying war with China.
And war with China, you know, increasing tensions and war with China over China's appropriation of the islands in the South China Sea. None of that has come to pass. But what has happened is the continued political disintegration of the party system in the United States, and a situation which looks like, at the national level, that the country is unable to govern itself because the political elite are unable to agree on how this country should and can be governed. And then you have Trump and what he represents. And what he represents is not insignificant, although at times it appears that he is on an island, isolated from the political class, the ruling elite, as it were. But the fact that he doesn't concede much to them is very significant, especially on issues of imperial retreat and questions of resetting the terms of the U.S. relationships with the major centers of economic power in the world, by which I mean Europe, the European Union, China, and Russia. So I think 6 months out, the political crisis has deepened. It seems to not be resolvable upon the terms of the two-party system, but there is not yet indications that what is new and what will replace this system in crisis. It does not appear that that new formation is yet ready to be born.
You know, a lot of the things that both that you alluded to now, but also larger set, things that we've been discussing for the last, well, it's been a year this month since the two conventions, and so for at least the last year and a half, almost 2 years now, people are finally starting to come around to, you know, at least introducing into the conversation, both as a framework for understanding what has happened over the last year or two, an example being Schumer's acknowledgement of the role of economics and, you know, the personal condition, economic condition of working class people in the country having a role in the defeat of Hillary Clinton. And also the open discussion in a number of areas, including the U.S. military, this thing, Department of Defense, looking at multilateral or you know, multipolarity in the world, the you know, end of or move away from the idea of American hegemony and exceptionalism to a more realistic view, which we've said either Trump or the part of the elite behind him may well represent. And you know, we're starting to see this kind of stuff being more openly acknowledged, even as the attack on Trump steps up.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. This situation where the Democrats and Chuck Schumer, who is not a very articulate or very clear thinking person, at least he understands, like Bernie Sanders does, that identity politics is not a recipe for political victory in a situation where over half of the American population are either in poverty or close to it. In other words, the Democratic Party, or for that matter, any party, has to base its program, its policies, upon the working class, not upon identity politics and a coalition of all of these identity coalitions or groups, be they black, brown, gay, queer, or disabled, or whatever. That what unites all of these identity sectors is the common situation of economic decline of the country and the rapid deterioration of the conditions of working people. And unless you address that, there is no way that you can even win an election. Now, what Schumer is saying or said is that we have to do what Trump did in 2016, which, by the way, is what we, you and I, Don, said, is that the Trump strategy was a strategy that would or could win. Now, we didn't know that he would, but it could win. The fact that he remained competitive with one-tenth of the money that Hillary had and none of the endorsements, nothing from Wall Street, nothing from the media.
Massive media antipathy, as a matter of fact, like being carpet bombed every day by the media.
Absolutely. And he won because he went to those states where the working class was in the greatest trouble. And that was it. And the fact that people say, well, he didn't win the popular vote. Well, unfortunately, we have a system which elects presidents not based upon the popular vote. But, and here is the positive side of the whole thing, in the states that made it possible for him to win, the working class is in the deepest trouble and is most outraged and prepared for fundamental change. As it turns out, Trump is not the fundamental change, but he's opened the door to that fundamental change. The failure of the left, narrowly conceived or broadly conceived, is that it is too tied to the narrative of the neoliberal elite, especially those that run the Democratic Party. And the left has no future as long as it remains in one or another way tied through NGOs or through money or in foundations or just through intellectual and ideological laziness to the Democrats and to the neoliberal elites. The left in this country has no future.
You know, the irony like drips from this stuff from Schumer right now, because not only did Trump focus on those places where these chunks of precarious workers were available and ended up being decisive, not only did he farm those places aggressively, but Clinton almost as aggressively ignored them. We're talking Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. We spent more time courting those voters than she did.
Yeah. In fact, she attacked them. She demonized them as racist, as really scum and white trash.
Irredeemable.
That was her approach to them. Yep. Whereas Trump said, "I hear and I understand your pain."
Yep.
I mean, who are you going to vote for?
Right. That's right.
So
I mean, there was no alternative. Yeah.
So here we are. Now, of course, this brings up the question of the Green Party and its recent convention in Newark, New Jersey, and what it's going to do going forward. Now, I think the brand was severely damaged when Jill Stein joined the Russia Gate thing.
Right.
And, got a lot of money for it. But other than that, the Green Party brand is in real trouble. And at their convention, there seems to be a deepening split along ideological and, to a certain extent, racial lines.
Right.
Concerning who the Green Party should unite with.
Yeah.
And you got two sides in this debate, fundamental sides. One side is predisposed to go towards the Bernie-crats, which would take them back into the Democratic Party.
Right.
The other side is for going to the working class, the working people, and uniting with them irrespective of how they voted in November or how they vote traditionally, uniting with them on the basis of working class issues, yeah, like jobs, like a guaranteed income, like universal health care, right, like infrastructure development, and like peace. So
right.
I would agree with the latter rather than what I think is the Jill Stein predisposition, which is also the position of Democratic Socialist of America, that we will take over the Democratic Party. And the takeover of the Democratic Party, and I put that in quotes, policy, which many Greens, I'm certain, are in favor of, would then make the Green Party superfluous and unnecessary.
Right.
But then if you read a person like Bruce Dixon, his argument is that he is fighting to turn the Green Party into a mass revolutionary or mass radical party. Now, I think that is also a mistake. I don't think it could happen given what the Green Party is. And I'm not saying that the Green Party, what it is not a necessary a player. But you cannot turn a small party whose purpose was protest and protesting through its candidates the policies of the two major parties, you can't turn that into a revolutionary party of the people.
And,
I'm sorry.
No, that's right. Because there's also, I just want to, before we develop that further, you were talking about the dichotomies that existed in, here, the split between this and this and this and this, and there's another split, not just over whether to look at class or these other issues, but there's also one, both a virtual and a material argument going on the question of race. The virtual one, and this is what Bruce probes this. This isn't the point of his article, but it's pretty well developed. That you just putting a black face that's unconnected. Right. It's not an organic, like lifting of someone from a community into a position, but looking around the room and saying, okay, there's a black guy. Okay, you're a leader of this caucus. And expecting that somehow that means black people appear behind him all of a sudden and working on a mission that, actual black folks might put together for themselves as a program. He said that's not what's happening. And so there's a division between the people that want to portray things inside that paradigm and those that see the real problems with race there that we saw, for example, during Cynthia McKinney's campaign.
No, I agree. I mean, but the Green Party, like the political system as a whole, is at a moment of truth. And everybody is trying to figure out how to move forward. Chuck Schumer and those, of course, in an opportunist way. And so the Green Party is trying to figure out how to go forward. And that's a question of how it's going to be structured, whether it be a loose coalition of local groups or whether it be a highly structured, organized party that looks something like a very radical revolutionary party with forms of democratic centralism and membership dues and all of that. So it has to decide. Now, with the ideological and race questions, and Bruce is absolutely right to raise this, that a black caucus is not a guarantor of real and significant black leadership arising out of that to the executive or steering committee.
Yeah, I think in terms of in the abstract, what we're talking about, in my opinion here, is how both the movement, really, but the Green Party is going to relate to the question of race, whether it's going to be on a material historical basis or if it's going to be within the realm of identity politics, quote unquote.
Right. Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right about that. And how leadership, period, in a broadly conceived left party like the Green Party is chosen. And leadership is very, very important. And it is not just, as you just pointed out, it's not just a matter of identity. It is also a question of ideology, politics, and experience, and really commitment in the field to whatever the Green Party is about. So the Green Party is in a crisis, but I am of the opinion that more than a new party, what we need is a new movement. Mm. And in a certain sense, Bruce Dixon was gesturing to the idea of more grassroots and local activism. And out of that, you grow the Green Party. I am thinking, however, that out of that, you grow a movement of a new type, a movement that has a program, but that is and broadly conceived ideological positions, but which is anchored into local struggles and local coalitions and local communities, which is a wholly different thing than a party that really comes out every 4 years to run for president. We need more than that. We need a 365-day movement that is fighting on all kinds of issues that people are experiencing. And I think, and let me just end with this point, I think that such a movement must target the main centers of population and financial and economic activity, not exclusively, but you have to have such a movement in a place like Philadelphia, mm-hmm. in a place like Chicago, right. in a place like Birmingham, Alabama,
Gary,
in a
Indiana.
Place like, Indiana. These central places of population, but also places where the working people are suffering the greatest.
Yeah. Yeah, they're certainly going to be the most highly motivated. Pain is a hell of a motivator.
I
brought this other point up before, and I want to distill it even further. We're talking about, in the case, say, of identity politics, we're talking about mm-hmm. either the substantive or the symbolic. With mm-hmm. identity politics being the symbolic, they're mm-hmm. appointing this black person, this gay person, this woman, whatever, into this position mm-hmm. does not inherently mean that any other woman or black person or whatever is going to get a single benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's an inference mm-hmm. of that. It's a right. it's a symbol that the exclusion of those people as a class from participation mm-hmm. in society is ending with the crack that allowed this one person to seep through. But mm-hmm. in fact, it's not a substitute for a material change where these distinctions no longer matter in terms of power. We ain't mm-hmm. there. And so while the movement that you talk about is assembling I'm wondering if we can look towards, where are those folks, the members of it, standing right now? How do they self-identify? Does that matter? You know, if these million people that could tomorrow be behind a march for, you know, economic justice and peace, if they consider themselves left, alt-left, right, alt-right, whatever, does that matter to their utility moving forward, and their, you know, the ability of them to even be integrated solidly into what comes next in a healthy way?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. I mean, the Democratic corporate Democrats don't understand that. I don't know if Bernie Sanders people fully understand what you're saying. This is why they keep floating this thing of who's going to be their candidate in 2020. And now they're talking about this woman from California, Kamala Harris. And I guess the Bernie-crats are thinking about Nina Turner. But, you know, it's the old game of, if you get the right personality, you can build a coalition that can win an election, a presidential election, around that personality without demonstrating a true commitment to the issues that affect working people. But and if that's what the Democrats are thinking, and it looks like that's what they are thinking, they're going to lose in 2020. I mean, they're talking about impeaching Trump. That's not going to happen. So the next best thing is to defeat him in 2020. I don't think that's going to happen. So if they continue along the lines that they're talking about. So, but then where does that put the people and the organizers and the mass movement? And I think outside of the two parties in the electoral arena, what we need is a third force that unites people irrespective of how they have voted or intend to vote or whether they don't vote at all. But I'm of the opinion that when you hit the working class and the poor, the vast majority of them are not interested in either party. They're interested in a movement that can clarify and give leadership to the issues that are affecting them and their children. And I'm calling it, a third force outside of the two parties that's not looking to 2020, but is looking to tomorrow and today and the day after tomorrow. And what do you do? What can you do for me? And out of that, things can happen. In so creating, we are transforming the political landscape. And it's not going to be done through a, quote, new party or a more revolutionary green party or a, you know, which I think is a fool's errand, the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, or a combination of them and others taking over the Democratic Party. That's not the way to go. That's intellectual laziness. That's a lack of political will, political courage, or of ideological clarity.
Yeah, I mean, that's a petty bourgeois approach to something.
Absolutely, yeah, right. Absolutely. And it's most prolific among academics and those who can theorize as armchair revolutionaries and know nothing at all about the thinking and sentiments of people who are suffering under this regime of neoliberalism and war.
Yeah. Look, I mean, here's the question. Seriously, in the history of humanity, is there anything that would give an indication that the ruling class of today, which has complete control of the media, of all mass communication, of the political party structures of both political parties, is going to allow those instruments to be utilized to vote it out of power?
I don't think so. And you know, that's why we have to think anew. And, you know, one of the things that you and I have discussed, and I hope we can do it in the future, is to talk about and think about how to think in this moment. You know, and one, you know, we have been talking about this for some time, and in some ways, not just critiquing, but ridiculing the ways that so-called important thinkers have been thinking about a moment like this. And one of the things that you and I have agreed upon is that people are thinking wrong. They're thinking about a moment of disintegration and crisis of a system as though we were in a period prior to this crisis.
Right.
And it's all off. And I think we have to think about that, because in thinking about how to think, we will also be able to think about how to come forward with a political strategy, political tactics that fit this time in history.
You know, I agree that that's exactly the locus of the problem. And from that follows, and this is something else that we've discussed, it's not just that people think they're reliving 1932 or 1933.
Right. Or even 1917.
Okay, right. It's also that they perceive of and even conceive of the elements as being those of the 1930s. For example, the classes and the relationship of the classes and the relationship of the class those classes to, say, the means of communication, the means of production, the nature of the global economy. All the conditions are different. Even the players are different.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't really see a theory different. Resting on that.
Yeah, fundamentally different. Yep. You know, so fundamentally different. I don't know what people are thinking about or talking about. First of all, there was one center of power in the world, and that was the Euro-American world.
Right.
Most of humanity was under one another form of colonialism or semi-colonialism. Imperialism. Euro-American imperialism was the dominant system. Of course, you had the Soviet Union, but it was, in a lot of ways, alone and isolated as a single socialist country. Today, you have the vast majority of the world united against the Euro-American hegemon.
Right.
And not just united in statements, but in actual building of new competing institutions, right, such as the One Belt, One Road project initiated by the Chinese, or such as the Asia Infrastructure Bank,
yeah,
or such as the BRIC Bank,
yeah. Yeah.
Or the Shanghai Cooperation Organization,
right,
or Mercosur.
Or
I mean,
SALAC.
You go on,
yep,
on and on and on.
BRICS.
In fact, BRICS. Even, you know, the geography of the world as imagined in the period of colonialism and imperialist hegemony is different. You know, the concept of Middle East will soon be absent from our political discourse, because the Middle East, as it is now called, will be defined as what it really is: Western Asia, or an appendage to Northeast Africa.
Right.
You know, Europe will no longer be seen as a, quote, separate continent, but will be seen
Eurasia.
As a part of the Eurasian
right.
continent.
Right.
I mean, you know, we're in a fundamental transformation of the organization of humanity as
right.
such.
That's
and
right.
hence we're moving from the age of Europe to the age of humanity. In fact, I would suggest that the idea of Europe will soon disappear from human thinking as Europe becomes a part of humanity. I mean, this is something so spectacular
and epical.
Most people cannot and epical.
Professor Montero, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.